The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to introduce our guests. Playwright and professor William DeCanzio teaches in the Pannoni Honors College of Drexel University. His plays Johnny Is Gone for a Soldier and Dooley have been staged in New York City, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles, among many other places. He has been honored with the Julie Harris Playwright Award, a Brown Foundation Award, and residencies and fellowships from the McDowell and the Eugene O'Neill Theater's National Playwrights Conference. On the 50th anniversary of the publication of E.M. Forster's contemporary classic, Morris, DeCanzio has created a compelling new novel entitled Alec, which surrounds and extends Forster's original work. One reviewer writes, "Heartfelt, sexy, and luminously written, DeCanzio's novel conjures the Forsterian spirit to bring Alec and Morris into the modern world. The deft interweaving of queer history, queer fiction, queer biography, and sheer imagination kept me thinking and open to surprise. I loved it." That critique was written by Wendy Moffitt, author of A Great Unrecorded History, A New Life of E.M. Forster, which Janet Maslin, writing in the New York Times, described as an insightful, revelatory portrait. Moffitt is a professor of English and Curley Chair of Global Education at Dickinson College, and our interviewer this evening. Wendy, William, only connect. The screen is now yours.
Thank you, Andy, and thank you so much to the Free Library and to Bill for this wonderful opportunity for this event. I'm really excited, and I hope that we'll have some good questions so that we're not doing all the talking during the hour.
Should I say thank you to Wendy?
Do, please.
Okay. Hello, everyone. And I am very grateful to the Free Library for hosting this event, and to Professor Moffitt. I have to tell you that without her biography of E.M. Forster, I would not have written Alec. I mean it very sincerely, that her work was as much an influence on me as Forster's novel itself.
Well, that is a very wonderful thing to hear from you, Bill, and the feeling of excitement and pleasure and delight in reading this novel feels very Forsterian to me. I began to read in galleys and stayed up pretty much all night to finish it because it had a sort of gallop to it that was really wonderful. I'm urging everybody to pay attention to that. I wanted to ask you a little bit about its origins. How long has this been brewing in you in the sort of broadest sense? Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started on thinking sure. about writing this novel?
Yeah, it was, I know I made the first note for it because I'm in 2010, because I misspelled Alec's name. I just scribbled something on my computer and I said, Morris and Alex. And then I read your biography of Forster. And you persuaded me of an instinct that I'd already had. And that was, there was more of the story to tell. And you, when you reminded us of Forster's own notes to the novel, and his attempt to write an epilogue and to imagine the happily ever after that he was determined to have for Morris and Alec, I realized there was more of the story to tell. And also there's that very poignant observation of his that Forster's novel ends in 1913. And in his imagination, the happily ever after for Morris and Alec was that they were going to go off in the woods somewhere and live in a quiet life in seclusion, away from the disapproval scrutiny and scrutiny of the law, English society. I mean, their relationship was illegal. It was a crime. And then the war happened. And the Great War, for us, the Great War was upstaged in our educations by the Second World War. I mean, just completely overwhelmed by it. Even to the revision of the name, that the Great War, which was the war to end all wars, became World War I. So and then there was the sequel, World War II. But I really think that it was the formative trauma of our era. I think it's Gertrude Stein who said that the United States was the first country to enter the 20th century because the Civil War, in the Civil War, Sherman used total war, which would not be used in Europe until the Great War. And somehow these horrible catastrophes are what are propelling our recent history. And by that, I mean the last 200 years.
Well, if you talk to people at the War College in Carlisle, they don't really make much of a distinction between the First and Second World War in a sort of geopolitical sense, because I think it's all the same thing. But I think you're right in a significant way that Forster couldn't imagine his protagonists going into modernity, right? It's not just the cataclysm of the war, it's the whole modern world, which didn't seem to have space for them. We know that story. We know you and I know Morris, and we're talking about that. I'm wondering if you think that your readers need to know that novel in order to enjoy yours.
No.
Okay.
No. The short answer is no. I'm not. That's an assignment you don't have to take on yourself. You don't need to read Morris to enjoy Alec. But Morris is a great novel. And one of my hopes all along with Alec is that Alec would stimulate a new wave of interest in Morris, which has, mostly been a little bit overshadowed by Howard's End and A Room with a View. So I would say, read Alec first and then read Morris and see what I did to Forster and then decide whether you like it or not. And, I avoided watching what I have heard described as the swoon-worthy Merchant Ivory movie that was released, I think in 86 or 87. It was like Grant's first starring role. I saw it when it came out, but I avoided rewatching it while I was working on the novel because I didn't want to be influenced by the film. But that would be another way to get caught up on the story. And I'm sure you can stream it. I know you can stream it.
Yes, that's an interesting question. I as a Forster biographer, I was really impressed with how much work and reading you must have done to really feel the queer past in the way that it needed to be understood on its own terms. And what I'd like you to do, if you don't mind, because it's so full of, that past is full of surprises. Can you just sort of expound a little without telling the plot of the novel about the kinds of things that you learned as you read about the world that Alec grew up in as a queer man?
Oh, I have him. I'm writing from my own experience that I knew from a very early age, as Alec does, that he's one of those, that he's gay.
Forster did too, right? He has that wonderful kind of almost magical moment in his very early childhood, like he's 5 or 6 or something. And he thinks to himself in a sort of incantatory way, it all depends if it's a man or a woman who comes across the sidewalk next as he's looking out a window. And it's a man, and he's intensely relieved. It's only in retrospect that he realizes that that was about him being gay in a sort of pre-sexual acknowledgement.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, right?
Yeah. So so even as a little kid, I was aware of that this was something very, very bad, something to be hidden, to be ashamed of. I was also, you know, I was raised in a fairly devout Catholic family and raised and sent to school. So this was all being reinforced by the religious education. And kids are smart. And at a very early age, I remember understanding what was then the medical assessment of homosexuality, and that was that it was a mental illness. Somehow, in the 50s and 60s, that was kind and compassionate, that it wasn't a crime, at least not in the United States. In England, it remained a crime until 1967. But that, you know, that we weren't criminals, we were just sick. And that informs character. And it was, you know, it was, so Alec is aware when he's growing up of the unspeakable crime of Oscar Wilde. I mean, these are phrases, a phrase that has been in his head, and he's scared of it. And therefore, it's a big, his fairly early acceptance of his sexual nature is extraordinary.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting. Forster, of course, picks Morris, as he describes it in his nonfiction writing about writing the novel, as somebody who's very unlike himself. And then he goes through a whole list, you know, of sporty, in all kinds of ways, kind of normally masculine, as Forster himself didn't feel himself to be, right? So it's an interesting kind of projection. Alec feels like a character who's comfortable with himself, right? Right, pretty much from the beginning. In fact, he thinks, well, this won't get me into the kind of trouble that boys get into because I won't knock anybody up, right?
By the time he's figured out, by the time he's a teenager and knows how reproduction works, he can see a certain advantage to not to being gay, and that he's not going to get into trouble with girls. But he also is open to the notion that everybody has to get married, and he might indeed have to marry a woman, and because that's what people do. And so as a teenager, he also makes an attempt to establish that he can function in a heterosexual way if it should be necessary, if life should show him that, okay, it's expected that you're going to get married, and so you will, and yeah, I can do this.
Well, and of course, part of that is, at least at that time, questions about kinship and family, right? That's the only way to have a family. This is what Clive does in Morris, of course, is he kind of succumbs to the need to have that country house be carried on and that sort of thing. And there's a poignancy to that as well, I think. Tell us a bit about some of these wonderful historical figures like Edward Carpenter, who kind of, if you're not a historian of 19th century and early 20th century Britain, that might not be a name that people have heard of. And the world is populated, the queer world is populated with these extraordinary people who seem to manage to live on their own terms pretty much in broad daylight, and yet we don't know about them. I think of him as a sort of English Whitman, but that's because I'm
yeah.
So tell us about Edward Carpenter and his role in sort of your historical view of the past, but also his role in this novel.
Well, he appears as a character in Alec. He and his life partner, George Merrill, they're the kind of wisdom figures in the novel. They are much older than Alec and Morris. When we meet Carpenter, he is 70. Merrill was considerably younger. He was in his mid-40s. There was, more than 20 years between the two men. But they lived near Sheffield in the country, openly, and they didn't hide anything from anyone. Carpenter is a name that we all should know, Edward Carpenter, because genealogy, especially for gay people, our genealogy tends to be carried on through relationships rather than family. And Forster knew him, Carpenter knew Whitman, and you can trace this kind of family tree. He was a wonderful man. He had actually been, he came from a well-to-do family, went to Cambridge, like Forster, was ordained clergy in the Church of England, and served as a curate for a little while, and then finally renounced his ordination and the Church of England because of its teachings about homosexuality. And Carpenter was an uninhibited thinker. He was he believed that because this was part of his nature, his sexual orientation, nothing he had sought, nothing that he preferred, that it was part of nature and therefore must be good because it's part of God's creation. And that was the way he lived his life.
This probably accounts for him also gardening in the nude, which
like Adam. Yeah.
It's a particularly English kind of version of that eccentricity. I believe he did wear sandals, that somebody
made himself.
Yes, but you have to draw a line somewhere. You don't want to step on something sharp, right? I do love this sort of image. He was the father of Morris, at least that's what Forster said, right? That Forster describes going to see Carpenter as a pilgrimage, which is for a non-believing, lapsed Church of England, Anglican, he to use that word is a very, it's made Carpenter into a kind of secular saint, right? That's an important thing.
And so, if Merrill was, Carpenter was the secular saint, his partner, George Merrill, was sort of the secular eros, maybe a little bit of a satyr, but he, I'm sure I probably read about it in your biography, Forster, where Forster's out with a stroll with him, and Merrill puts his arm around his back and touches him in a way that just, electrifies Forster. I guess he was, their relationship was so important to that of Morris and Alec, was because we Americans are prone to overlook how very important the distinction and separation of social class was in England, that Carpenter came from a well-off family of means. Merrill grew up in his father was an alcoholic. He was one of many, many children. They had no money. He went to work at an early age. And so in his household, the idea of Victorian morality, Victorian patriarchy was turned upside down because the kids were taking care of dad and the mother was overwhelmed with trying to feed the kids.
It's Dickensian almost. It's got this kind of overwhelming sense of the sort of undertow of poverty. That gap between sort of respectable middle to upper middle class and working class or even poorer obtains in your novel too, right?
Yes.
I mean, isn't that the tug of war between Morris and Alec in some ways?
Well, yeah, they've both been, Morris has is the victim of his own elite education. I mean, he has really been raised to believe himself to be superior to the lower classes. And Alec, on his hand, just despises them all for their ignorance and pretenses. But it plays out in my novel in a really poignant way because of the difference in social class, even though they, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but not too much. Even though they hope to serve together when they enlist for the war, they're thwarted in that. It's absolutely impossible because Morris is tapped for officer training and Alec is, and the conventions at the time they couldn't even write to each other. There was, of course, censorship in place, but any communication between the officers and everybody else who was called the other ranks was absolutely frowned on.
It's an interesting thing. In Forster's own life, he was too old for the war initially, close to 40, and he worked as a Red Cross searcher in Alexandria. So what he did was, after the terrible Gallipoli campaign with huge numbers of wounded and missing coming in, he kind of detectived his way into figuring out whether people were still living, people who'd lost their memory, all sorts of things like that. And he has a sort of Whitman-esque function there too, of nursing the wounded as Whitman did in the Civil War. And he reads Whitman very consciously about that as well. And it's the first time that he properly runs into working class men without them just being sort of objects who are not in his orbit at all. He falls in love with an Egyptian man who's a good bit younger than him and from a much lower class, but they find canny ways to hide in plain sight because everybody assumes their relationship is master and servant. So they actually sort of turn the bigotry and expectations about sexuality on its face, and turn it around a little bit. Did you find that Alec and Morris were able to play canny games with expectations of other people?
Oh, yes. I'm just thinking that early on in their relationship, they are mistaken for master and servant, for employer and employee. And they are upfront about, there's one scene where they're checking into an inn together, and the innkeeper assumes that they wish to be roomed separately. And Mara says, "Oh no, no, one room will suffice for the two of us." So, yeah, I think they can get away with that to a certain degree, and then there's a degree to which they can't when they're living together as a young couple in London. Morris, like all the gentlemen of his class has a dining club where he takes his meals when he's in the city. But since Alec would not be welcome there, he doesn't eat there anymore. So they both go equally hungry. So it goes both ways.
That's interesting. I'd love it if you could give us a little bit of a taste of what this novel sounds like. Do you have a place you could jump in and just read a paragraph or two so that we can...
And that'd be, Wendy, if you don't mind, what you were saying about Forster and this sort of intersection of biography and history and fiction, and about his time in Alexandria, I'd like to read a short passage from a conversation that happens between Alec and Morgan, which is the name of Forster's character in the novel, not the character based on him. Alec and Morgan had become acquainted years before when Morgan was serving as a volunteer teacher in the Working Men's College, which was an effort in the early 20th century to offer the benefits of higher education to the working classes. So these idealistic, very privileged young graduates of Cambridge and Oxford would offer a class. And Alec happened to have taken a class with Morgan, which was where they met. And I'll just read a little something from after the war, where Morgan is talking about his what the war has done for him. And he talks about the relationship, the biographical relationship that Forster had with the Egyptian man whom he met in Alexandria. So here we are. This is a late night scene between, it's just Morgan with his former student, Alec, and it's and they're having a private conversation. Morgan says, "The war has forced memories on me, as it has on you and Morris, of things I'd wished I'd never seen, things I wished I'd never even heard about. Shattered my beliefs. What I've been taught to call civilization and barbarism, the war turned those ideas upside down, along with my notions of being English or being a man." He finished his brandy. "It hurt like hell and still does." He poured a bit more. "Respectability. That's what I once called my way of life. In truth, it was cowardice." Alec said, "I've always thought of you as brave. In the trenches, when I think of you, I'd say to myself, I'm lucky to know such a man." "How kind you are," Morgan said. "Before the war, I'd no experience with sex or intimacy. That's changed now. I'm glad for you. Sex was easy once I'd made up my mind. So many of us lonely men, patients and medics at the hospital where I worked, right on the beach at Alexandria, what a scene. Scores of convalescing soldiers playing in the sea all day, as naked as if they'd never worn clothes, and lying on the sand side by side well into the evenings. To no one's surprise, there was a trysting place." Alec grinned. "And so?" Morgan said, "And so?" Alec said, "Wonderful." "Yes," Morgan said, "entirely delightful. But why had it taken a war to set me free? I'd pinioned myself, trapped myself, or aided those who had sought to do so. I look back and shake my head at my own cowardice. But love, I soon learned, and as you know well, takes far more effort than sex. We've so few models, men like us, for intimacy, for devotion that endures. By no fault of our own, How many of our stories have been expunged from history, from memory even? With no stories, we're made to feel alone, unnatural, ashamed. But I'm lucky. I know Ted and George, and you and Morris, so at least I understood what I was seeking.
It's a lovely thing. That's a lovely passage. I should point out to the audience who are listening that this is really a romance, this book you've written. It's very sexy and it's very romantic. I wonder if that's the way you think of it too, or if that's just my reading of it.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. That was the glory of Morris for me, and why it's such an important novel that I don't want to name names, but often when writers who are not gay men write about gay men, they get it wrong. In the most concrete way, they get the sex wrong. It strikes me that they are writing about the relationship between men as if it were a heterosexual relationship and not a very, often not very pleasant. But even a writer whom I so admire, Mary Renault, who's best known for those beautiful historical, those gorgeous historical novels like The Persian Boy. My favorite of her novels is not historical. It dates from the period of the Second World War, just after. It's called The Charioteer. It's a beautiful novel about veterans who have returned from the war, gay men who meet. And it is a wonderfully romantic novel in the sense that it's not about this sort of crude presentation of something that is objectified, but she can only go so far when it comes to the sexual actualization of the relationship between her heroes. She just steps back. There's nothing. So she's very good about the emotion, but she can't culminate the relationship sexually because it's not in her realm of experience.
That's really interesting. Forster found himself in a fascinating vice during a period of his life. He fell in love after the Egyptian man died young. He fell in love with a policeman, and the policeman was married, and the policeman was definitely bisexual. I have it on very good authority all around. And yet loved, really loved his wife and really loved Forster as well, and had an active sexual relationship with both of them. And it was a very, Forster describes what he wants in this intimacy as being almost like a marriage. He says this about him and Bob. And of course, there's also a sort of cadre of men who have been in the First World War, Isherwood and Auden among them, who are his friends, for whom that kind of idea is a huge sellout of the kind of routine misogyny and multiple partners that they imagine is the true freedom of being queer, right? So he gets sort of caught between neither really being straight nor really being queer enough for some of these younger men. A lot of them come around on his sort of prophetic qualities of the range of what intimacy could be. He wasn't really very judgy, but it's an interesting question. I want to just ask you one more thing because this feels so cinematic. And you're a playwright, This is your first novel. I think that's such an interesting thing to choose this form after writing plays. Do you imagine this, see this as a could it be a play? Could it be a movie? Could it be in another form, this love story?
I don't believe it can be a play because a play requires a great compression of time and place. I'm thinking of just to give a favorite example, West Side Story, for example, breaks our hearts with the events of a day and a half in a couple of city blocks. Alec takes years and nations, and it's just a big, expansive story that requires a novel. On the other hand, I have always, when I have taught dramatic writing, I have taught that while people think that movies are like plays, actually movies are much more like novels, that the camera is the narrator, and that there is no narrator in a play. So I wrote Alec imagining it as a film, and a few days after publication, a studio approached us with there is interest in doing a film version of Alec.
That's a romantic notion too, Bill.
Yeah. I decided that I want Rupert Graves to play Alec in the movie.
That.
I want him to play Alec's father.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. That's very clever.
What a heartthrob.
Yes, that's very clever. Well, it's time for us to stop talking just to ourselves and to open the doors to some of our audience who have wonderful questions. One that I think is quite interesting is, this is for you, Bill, was it an active decision that you make Alec gay rather than bisexual? This aspect of his identity continues to be debated by readers and within the 21st century Morris fandom. But we know that straight seemingness was part of the appeal of working class men to both Forster and particularly to some of his younger friends like Joe Ackerley. So this is a question about your conception of Alec's conception of his own sexuality, which is obviously tempered by cultural questions too. But
that's an amazingly articulate question. Thank you to whoever posed it. I decided to make him gay because I could reach into myself and share that with my character. But I also think that it's absolutely true to Alec that he sort of brags to Morris that, oh, I could get a kid like that. And he snaps his fingers, but in my novel, when Morris brings that up to him again, you know, about that, he will admit that it was swagger and that it was immature, and that even while he was saying that after he had experienced even the first few days of his love for Morris, he knew he could not marry a woman.
That's interesting. Here's an interesting question. Who made the drawing for the cover of your book? It's a lovely cover.
I'm so glad you asked. It gives me a friend. The artist's name is Paul Dussold, Dussold. He is a friend of mine in both senses, in that he's a neighbor and we're buddies, but I attend a Quaker meeting here in Philadelphia, and Paul attends the same friends meeting. I'm so glad that Farrar, Straus and Giroux chose the portrait that he did, because I was, when I approached him, I was really kind of nervous because I love his work. And he's trained at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. He's really proud of the Philadelphia tradition. And he is a professional portraitist. His stuff is gorgeous. Google him. He's wonderful. But so I asked him if he would do a drawing of the title character, a portrait, not knowing if FSG would choose it for the cover or not. I certainly didn't have the authority to insist on that. But so I was delighted when they saw the portrait and loved it. And the designer of the cover, Rodrigo Corral, chose to frame it in white. He actually tinted the background of the drawing to gray. And there's one more bit of provenance that's very special to me. When Paul was working on the drawing, I asked him, but my father's first job, first enterprise as a young man to support his family, was to open an art supply store. And he it didn't last for too long, shortly after the Second World War. But so he had some of his stock when he closed the business, he kept. And among it were a couple of folios of drawing paper that were so fine that you could buy it by the sheet. And I asked Paul if he would like some of this paper, and he said, sure. So the drawing of Alec, the model is a friend of his daughter's. The drawing of Alec is executed on a piece of paper that is at least 8 years old from my father.
That's wonderful. That's like the way that you sort of fold, you know, real, the sort of mystical way that, you know, real characters show, real people show up as characters. There's a kind of porousness between the present and the past in this novel. That has a real life analog to it. That's wonderful. Here's an interesting question that I think we both could ruminate on. Did the Forster revival in contemporary fiction begin with Zadie Smith's On Beauty? Or was it later? It seems lately there's been a recent spate of Forster-inspired books. Any ideas why? I'm thinking also, you know, The Inheritance, the wonderful play on Broadway in which Forster figures as a character. He's cropping up as a character, or his plots are getting, you know, sort of built on in beautiful ways. Do you have a thought about why Forster is a man for our time?
I would love to hear your answer to that question, Wendy. I can just say that it seems to me that the world is catching up to him, but you are so knowledgeable about his, and you also seem to know a lot about like contemporary culture and stuff. So what do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm delighted by it, of course, but it's a little bit like the sort of Austin getting picked up again. And I think, somebody actually a little while ago, a student said to me, you know, we were talking about ethics in writing and people being great writers and great people. And she said, you should teach a course on great writers who are great people. And I said, it's kind of a short list. It's probably Forster and Austin, who are two people I teach a fair amount. And Austin could be pretty waspish. But I think his out of timeness, right? His sense that when he wrote Morris, that there wasn't a place in the world for it, but he hoped that there might be, right? He dedicates it to a happier year, which is clearly a lot closer to now than it was to the time when he wrote it. So I think there was a quality of his, which I love, which is that he imagined things that he had neither experienced nor seemed possible in the world in which he lived. Things about queer intimacy, things about possibilities. There's a wonderful story. I pieced together some sort of mystifying things. He writes a note to someone, which is, I'm just paraphrasing because I can't remember it exactly, but it's in 1927. And he says, what with being blackmailed on Tuesday and Bow Street on Wednesday, life has been quite a whirl. He's sort of acting like this isn't freaking him out. He actually had sort of gotten caught and blackmailed by a Coldstream guardsman who had turned his random sexual encounter into an opportunity for blackmail. And it was terrifying for him. He felt he was going to be exposed. He thought he might go to prison. But then the next day, he goes to Bow Street, where the big Radcliffe Hall case is being heard on being brought up on obscenity. And he testifies as this sort of very mainstream Eminem's crees about how this is really good literature and you shouldn't censor it. So you can see this sort of shape-shifting that's going on there. He's depending on false ideas in the public about his respectability and playing that towards a kind of civil rights for queer fiction. It's very, very complicated. And I think that quality of him, like, not really feeling that he lives in the right moment for quite a good bit of his life, makes him a wonderful figure who's both modern or even postmodern sort of prescient about things, and also his great humanism and toleration, I think, makes him somebody interesting to read on matters of sex and gender and race, and lots of his contemporaries feel dated or feel troglodyte, you know, really, really politically wrong. It's hard to read Kipling anymore without just rinsing, right? So I think that that's my grab.
I want to just jump. You said great writers who are great men. This showed me that E.M. Forster was a great man as well as a great writer. I'm holding up Professor Moffat's biography.
That is very kind.
Not ask me.
Here I am. This. Okay, I see.
But this is a terrific book. It's a terrific book.
I appreciate that very much. What I felt that was when I was moved to hear you say that you had been thinking about this since 2010. Since it takes me about a decade to do things, and it took me a decade to research and write that. Part of the reason was that Forster did have a really interesting will. He said he curated and kept a huge archive of his queer experience, but it was open to anyone, but he prohibited mechanical reproduction of any sort. So anybody who's been in an archive knows, if you can't Xerox it, if you can't take a picture of it, I transcribed 12,000 letters, something like that, right? So it's a very painstaking process, but my kind of romance of the archive was meant, he wanted intimacy from the researchers too. If you could have this knowledge, this very, very intimate knowledge of his sexual desire, of his sex life, of his yearning for intimacy, of his pain, but only if you took the time to read it sort of human to human, and not, I think that kept it from being a kind of salacious acquisition in his mind, right? So that's my read. But again, you know, you have to justify spending that much time. We only have time for a few more questions, but I like this one. Bill, did you feel liberated to write sex scenes in this era and not be censored in a way that Forster obviously felt he was?
Yes. Yeah, it was kind of fun. I've actually been happy to hear how people are responding to the sex. I mean, this is not too much of a spoiler alert. I mean, Alec is the first part of the novel, Alec is a teenager, and to be true to the character,
say no more.
When I was 16, could I think of anything else?
Yes.
It was liberating to be able to do that and not worry so much about how it was going to be. Yeah, I mean, you know, how it was going to be received. I didn't know. I a dear friend of mine who was a woman who's sadly widowed many years ago now. She said she's just getting into the novel, and she said, "No, and I was I was reading those scenes and I found them very interesting. And it just reminded me that how little is going on in my life. And I think I need to go out and start dating.
Oh, that's a very, yes, a fecund kind of
yeah.
Inspiration there. That's great. We've got a couple of questions that only you can answer, Bill, about what you're writing now and whether you have any plans to have a sequel after the ending of this, which I will not reveal.
The answer to both is yes. So I am, my current project is related to Alec. I'm trying not to be superstitious, but I don't want to jinx myself. So I've just gotten into this, but I have grown to love them so much. But I'll tell you what is really moving me forward on this next project is that, you know, Forster's sense of the great unrecorded history of queer people sort of being expunged, written out. What I have now that I have discovered this and know something about it, I will just say that the wisdom figures in the next novel are two women who are
That's very interesting. In
relationship. And yes, and they will.
Yeah, that's great. We have things to look forward to. That's wonderful. Here's a person who very kindly says, we've both added to the great unrecorded history of queer gay lives. Thanks, which is moved and inspired. And as I would say, we are by our readership as well. I wonder, here's a last thing for you to think about, Bill. Reader writes, I loved reading Alec. I found myself many times very emotionally moved by scenes. Was there any scene that moved you to tears in writing or working on its final form?
Yes, it is. Also, I'll be vague enough about this not to. It is when Alec returns to his family's cottage in Osmington after the death of his parents. And the cottage is empty. My parents, I'm also borrowing myself for the characterization. My parents died within days of each other, several years ago now, but I realized after my mother predeceased my father by a few days, and I knew when he died that he had been living for her because he believed that she needed him. And when he died, shortly after, I was grieving, but I was so annoyed with him. I was so angry. How could you do this? And then I realized how selfish children can be. That I realized that we were very fortunate in that when we were being raised, we were made to believe that we were the sort of the center of the marriage. But before we were on the scene, there was this profound, mystical, and of course, sexual love between these two people who were very young ones. And I realized that his death was about his love for her, that he might not know where she is now, but wherever she was, he wanted to be with her.
That's
so that,
That's a lovely thought of people inside and outside of time too, in real life, right? That you can't time travel. You can imagine though. And I just want to say to everybody, it's such a wonderful novel. I'm hoping that the word is spread. You've had lovely reviews, and I'm counting on more because people have good taste. With that, I think we'll thank our audience for joining us, which it's a wonderful conversation to have, and it's great to meet you, Bill. And so I'm just going to say thanks to everybody for your time, and thanks, Bill, for your beautiful work and for your wisdom on this and your heart. It's wonderful. And good night, everybody. Good night.
Thanks to the Free Public Library and to all of you folks who've been generous enough to join us tonight. And to you too, Professor Moffitt.
Thanks. We look forward to the next version. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.